Check out this man calmly strolling down a suburban street on a sunny afternoon, but he is not the father. The new twist in the kidnapping of an innocent three-month-old baby. Plus, a quiet town in Wisconsin rocked by this 10-year-old's murder. A suspect in custody tonight, and it is a juvenile suspect. We'll have the latest. And then, 6 months later, police release.
What's your job there with him?
I'm the armor. Or at least I was.
6 months later, police release hours of never-before-seen video from the live fire tragedy on the set of the movie Rust. All of it could be evidence, but where's the case? Plus, unretirement. Seniors forced to re-enter the workforce with inflation and gas prices rising every day. They simply can't afford to work and to not work anymore. And 25% of them made the exact same financial mistake when planning for their golden years. We will tell you what that mistake is and how you can avoid it. And finally, a dream home turned into a nightmare. 26 windows busted. But what caused this damage will leave you shocked. That is all ahead tonight on Banfield. Good evening and welcome to Banfield. I'm Brian Enten filling in for Ashley tonight. It is the tale of two kidnappings that have transfixed the nation for the last 24 hours, both with bizarre twists that leave us with more questions than answers. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month, and we wanted to make you aware of a few facts that may surprise you. 2,300 children per day are reported missing in the United States. 40% of children who are abducted by strangers are killed. And the first 3 hours is the most crucial for finding a missing child. It is why the last 24 hours have been so terrifying for two families. The first case is in San Jose, California. It is every parent's worst nightmare, and you can include grandparents as well. According to police, a grandmother put her three-month-old grandson inside her home and went back to her car to grab some groceries. In that very brief window of time, a suspect calmly walks right out of her house with baby Brandon still in his carrier. You see him there. Earlier today, three suspects were arrested in what authorities are saying was a planned kidnapping. It is all so strange. Let's turn now to News Nation's Nancy Liu. She has the latest on the case tonight. Nancy?
Well, Brian, this kidnapping happened in a window under 2 minutes. But San Jose police, they work quickly and nonstop, recovering baby Brandon in less than 24 hours. Tonight, he is back with his family, and three people are in custody.
This suspect appeared at the residence with a baby carrier. We do believe this was planned. It wasn't some random act. So the baby carrier that you see in that video is not the family's baby carrier.
So this was part of a premeditated plot. Many were stunned by this video of a young man in a baseball cap casually walking away with three-month-old Brandon Cuellar from his home in San Jose Monday afternoon. And the details were chilling. The baby snatched from inside his family's apartment as grandma was unloading groceries and mom was at work. San Jose police quickly unraveled what happened after questioning a woman who was with the grandma while shopping. They say her story was inconsistent, and police also got public assistance.
We followed every lead we had. We used information from witnesses, information from video surveillance that we located, and ultimately were able to find the baby.
Baby Brandon was recovered from inside a white van and taken to a hospital as a precaution. Neighbors are relieved.
Just happiness. Like, they thank God, you know, he's found, and in such a fast amount of time, too. It was good.
Police say one of those in custody is believed to be the man seen with the baby carrier, and all three are said to be connected to the family. It was something authorities had suspected from the start.
A stranger child abduction is extraordinarily a rare occurrence in this country. I think that's something we should all hopefully take comfort in. When it does happen, it's obviously a very high-impact threat. Low probability, but high impact.
Police are not releasing any information about the motives of the three people in custody. They are expected to be charged tomorrow. And Brian, those charges will more than likely include kidnapping.
It will certainly be very interesting to see what the connection is that the suspects do have to the family. Thank you so much, Nancy. We appreciate it. Okay, it was a very different outcome in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, a small city with just 14,000 people. According to police, 10-year-old Ileana Lily Peters was reported missing Sunday evening by her father after she left her aunt's house and rode her bike towards home just a few blocks away. Well, she never showed up. On Monday, just 12 hours later, her parents' fears turned into a living nightmare when Lily's body was found. Just a couple of hours ago, a suspect has been arrested, and it takes a very strange twist from there. It is a juvenile suspect. For more, I want to bring in News Nation correspondent Kelly Beeson. Kelly, tell us what's the latest tonight. I know there's been a lot of developments just in the last couple of hours.
There certainly have been, Brian, and authorities say they received hundreds of tips in this case. And this evening, we received this startling news from police.
This evening, we arrested a juvenile suspect in this case. The suspect was not a stranger. The suspect was known to the victim. We do not believe there is any danger to the community.
And authorities say they had been working tirelessly since discovering Lily Peters' body, adding that tips were critical in this case. Still, many questions remain, though, including how she died. The hours in between this announcement and Lily's confirmed death, the community of Chippewa Falls on high alert and mourning the loss of the 10-year-old girl.
She was just a sweet, innocent little girl. There needs to be some type of justice here.
In a city of 14,000, purple ribbons show signs of support for a community grappling with the news.
It's just so sad that this happened, and I just don't really know how to put it into words.
I don't think we've actually grasped it yet.
It comes after 10-year-old Ileana Peters, also known as Lily Peters, was found dead near a wooded trail Monday morning. Police calling the case an active homicide investigation.
The people of our community are honest, hardworking, and kind-hearted. It is almost impossible to believe that something this horrific could happen in our city.
9 p.m. Sunday night, Lily's father reported she had not returned home from a visit to her aunt's house, a location about five blocks away. Officers later found a bike in the woods near a walking trail north of both residences. Monday morning, the coroner's office confirming the body found in that same area is the body of Lily Peters.
There's just a void. There's a sadness. A deep hurting.
Just knowing that she went down that trail and that was that, the same trail my kids walked down by themselves all the time. It was a safe place up until Sunday.
And police saying now there is no further threat to the community. Brian.
And Kelly, it was just sort of shocking when they announced that this was actually a juvenile. A juvenile is the suspect. What do we know about exactly where this suspect was found tonight?
What was really interesting, our crews on the ground, Brian, in Wisconsin, are reporting that the search warrant police issued was at the aunt's home, where evidence was collected. Additional interviews were conducted as well. Now, no word on if there was a possible family connection here. We do know a forensic autopsy is being conducted, and we're still awaiting more details from police, Brian.
Thanks, Kelly. We know you'll stay on it. It'll be interesting to see as more details emerge about exactly how all of this unfolded. Someone who is unfortunately all too familiar with this horrifying scenario is Mark Klass. His daughter, 12-year-old Polly, was abducted at knife point from her own house during a slumber party. 65 days later, she was found, but she was the victim of murder. Her killer currently sits on California's death row at San Quentin State Prison. Mark joins us now. Also with us is Monique Lason. She is a private investigator and owner of Investigatrix, as well as the author of Children of the Underworld. Mark, I want to start with you. Unfortunately, both of these cases that we were just talking about do have similarities to what happened to your daughter. I cannot imagine what the first few hours are like for any parent when this is unfolding.
Well, first, it's in disbelief. I mean, you just, have a hard time reconciling the fact that the child that you always said you would keep safe is somehow missing. But ultimately, you start to realize the truth, what actually happened, and then fear takes over. And you're living in fear until the resolution.
And Monique, one interesting thing is Lily Peters, this all went down in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. That's a relatively small town, just over 14,000 people. I think a lot of parents think to themselves, gosh, this only happens in the big, dangerous cities. But this is actually happening in small towns, isn't it?
Actually, it happens often in small towns because it's a matter of trust. People believe that they are safe. They leave their doors open. They don't lock their cars. And they allow their children to go from one location to another, from home to school, or from one family to another by bike or walk through woods. And nobody really thinks that that could ever happen. So, and there are less surveillance cameras. The perpetrator actually targets small cities. And what they do, they watch the kids and they start thinking about the schedules and every day they follow them and they conduct some kind of a victimology. It's a profile that they have maybe for weeks in advance. And by the time
terrifying and fascinating. It totally surprised me. I would have assumed that it was the big cities where this was more common, but the fact that it's almost the opposite is so interesting. Former O.J. Simpson prosecutor Marcia Clark, she actually wrote a piece for the Daily Peace. I wanted to get your reaction, Mark, to this. She argues that when it comes to assaults and robberies, big cities have more crime, but with the kidnappings, it is actually the smaller towns. And she says that traditionally in the small towns, the parents sometimes wait longer to call the police because they think, well, surely nothing bad would happen here. I mean, it's just so interesting, Mark.
Well, in Lily's case, it was apparently well after dark before the parents contacted the authorities. But everything that you both said is absolutely true. Polly was kidnapped out of a town of 45,000 people that was considered a completely and totally safe town. So people did let their guard down. And also the perpetrator had stalked Polly for some period of time. And I think I'd like to point out one other thing, that a really good way people have to understand that a third of abduction attempts occur on school routes. So if we have some kind of programs, even neighborhood watch programs, to keep an eye on kids going to and from school, we could cut kidnapping in the United States by a third.
And it also seems so important that parents call the police right away. I think a lot of parents, especially in small towns, wait because they think, well, you know, maybe my kid is out riding the bike or at a friend's house and just didn't call. Monique, explain to us why that 3-hour window is so critical.
Because a lot of evidence can get lost, first of all, and people's memory kind of fade away with all the details that they need to know in order to help the law enforcement. So those 3 hours are crucial, especially for small children under 10 years old. Honestly, I think that it's a mistake to wait 72 hours, as a lot of people say. By then, most children don't survive.
And Mark, you started the Class Kids Foundation. Now you work with other parents who are going through this just unbelievably horrific time. Obviously, the first thing that they want to do is call police. But what else can they do right away to help the situation, to help find their kids?
Well, first of all, the best spokesperson for a missing child is going to be a parent. So what I would recommend doing is contacting the jurisdictional agency, then contacting other agencies in the community. In other words, you call the police and you call the sheriff. Then I would suggest you contact the FBI. They will come into a case at a family's request, and they have unprecedented resources and certainly more experience in this kind of crime than anybody else. Beyond that, I would suggest that people contact media assignment desks, just to let them know that once they're ready to start doing stories on this disappearance, once it's confirmed that there's a parent there willing to talk to them, then they should contact the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. They should contact friends, families, and neighbors, and then they need to start taking care of themselves, because sometimes, unfortunately, these things go on for long periods of time.
And one thing that I've noticed doing a lot of missing stories lately is that there's sometimes one person in the family who is very, very social media savvy, usually not one of the parents, and they're very distracted and overcome with grief, but maybe there's a cousin or a sibling that understands social media, and if they kick right into action, start an Instagram page, start a hashtag, start getting the word out, it seems it can really make a big difference. Have you noticed that, Monique? How important is social media right now, especially in the first, say, 24 hours, if you've got a kid that goes missing?
I definitely think that if people start combining forces and call their friends so everyone can get on social media to get the word out. But one thing that I have to say, while you are putting something on social media, so is the person who is also the perpetrator, who's following up with all the social media. And they follow your leads to distract the law enforcement. So you have to watch out. It has a double-edged sword. But I think that social media is very important, and everyone can get on it.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. I mean, you have to be careful in those early hours what you post, especially if your child is missing and there's not a suspect at that point. You need to make sure you don't put out any information that could compromise the investigation. Exactly. Or sort of tip off the possible suspect. Really, really good point. Mark, I want to show you this picture because I found this very interesting, and it also sort of shows how times have changed with all the important work you're doing. 1996, this is President Bill Clinton signing an executive order to make space available in federal buildings for missing children posters. It just shows all of the amazing work that you have done over the years. But it was also interesting to me because back then, you know, the posters in the buildings were so important. And we think about the milk cartons. But now everybody's on their phones with Facebook and Twitter. And you know, it's still so important to have the awareness. But the method has certainly changed, I think.
Well, President Clinton was very kind to me, and he certainly helped me establish my career as a child safety advocate. There's no question about it. He had me into the White House several times, and I greatly appreciate him for that. Back in 1993, my daughter was the very first missing child on the internet. I don't know if you knew that or not. We wanted to get her picture out to the relevant parties, to other cop shops, to TV stations, to hospitals, etc. Somebody actually had to mortgage their house to pay for stamps so we could send the flyers through the mail to do that. It took us 8 days from inception to the time they started arriving. Now, you can create a Facebook page, load it with multiple pictures, multiple links, testimonials. You can do all of this for free, and you can do it in absolutely no time at all. And I would suggest that is another step that families need to take almost immediately once a child has been confirmed to have been kidnapped or otherwise is in danger.
So fascinating to think how times have changed. Another interesting thing, Mark and Monique, is now you've got online sleuths who are on Twitter. I know a number of them who will immediately engage and start working on cases. And in many cases are extremely successful in helping the family figure things out and sometimes even helping law enforcement. And also you've got families that hire private investigators on their own to assist. Have you noticed that, Monique? And when is a good time for a family to decide, you know what, I think in addition to what the police are doing, we also need to get a private investigator?
Oh, absolutely. I think that people, a lot of parents, they don't even wait for the law enforcement to fail, because law enforcement has to go through a red tape, a lot of bureaucracy they have to go through. We don't have that. We have the freedom to immediately get on board, not to, you know, interfere with the crime scene. We don't want to do that. But definitely a lot of family and friends have to be interviewed. People remember things within the first few hours, if not days. Days might be even too late. So you have to get on. A lot of people hire private investigators because we do it faster. We don't have the restrictions that law enforcement has.
Such good advice from both Mark and Monique. We appreciate you being on so much tonight. I think so many people think this will never happen in my town. This will never happen to me. But sadly, it does happen. And I appreciate you giving your insight tonight to both of you.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay, moving on. After a break, we will see what police in New Mexico saw and hear what they heard the day an Old West movie gun fired a real bullet and killed a beloved filmmaker.
I take the gun out slowly. I turn on cock the pistol. Bang, goes up. She hits the ground. She goes down. He goes down, screaming.
Behind the scenes of a mystery that is yet to be solved, and there is so much new video that we have gone over today. We'll have it all when we come back.
32 Santa Fe, one female shot in the chest, male shot in the stomach, requested air flight.
It's been 6 months since Elena Hutchins was shot to death by a movie prop that wasn't even supposed to have blanks in the chamber, let alone a live round. And most of us thought we'd seen and heard everything there was to see and hear about the circumstances and finger pointing and police work on the set of the movie Rust. But we were wrong. This week, the Santa Fe County Sheriff's Office pulled back the curtain on literally hours of official body cam and interrogation video from that tragic day, including an overheard cell phone conversation between Alec Baldwin and his wife. The audio crackles, but you'll hear the film's leading man and co-executive producer complaining that he doesn't want to be a public person anymore. Take a listen.
No, what I am is someone who... I don't want to do this stuff anymore. I don't want to be a public person. And I'm the one holding the gun in my hand, and everybody was supposed to have taken care of. Handing a cold gun.
At this point, Baldwin likely did not know that Hutchins had died. We also see for the first time actual footage from the moments leading up to the shooting. This is Baldwin in full costume and with a gun that he did not know was loaded, practicing his cross draw with Hutchins and the film's director, Joel Sosa, on the other side of the camera. The bullet would pass through Hutchins and hit Sosa in the shoulder. He said this from his hospital bed.
Sorry,
it's okay. It's
a very loud bang, and it felt like somebody kicked me in the shoulder, and then I was down on my ass, and then I looked over and see the cinematographer, Helena Hutchins, with blood coming out of her back. Do you know anything about what's going on with her? Is she okay?
Hutchins was not okay, despite furious efforts that began on the floor of the set and continued all the way to the hospital that she was airlifted to. She didn't make it. When police questioned the movie's young armorer, Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, first in a squad car and later at the station, she seemed mostly concerned about Hannah Gutierrez-Reed.
I just want to get the out of here and never show my face in this industry ever.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Oh, I would. I'm like the only female armorer in the game, and I just up my whole entire career.
Career prospects remain to be seen, as do criminal charges against Hannah, against Baldwin, against the assistant director who also handled the gun, or really against anybody else at this point. Amazingly, the sheriff says he still has not gotten ballistics and forensic tests back from the FBI. And remember, it has been half a year now. I want to stop here and bring in a keen legal mind to help us sort through all of this. And there's a lot of new stuff here. Sarah Azari is a criminal defense attorney. She is based in L.A. First of all, Sarah, I want to ask you, were you surprised that all of this video was released? I mean, I had no idea there was even hours more video that we hadn't seen.
Yeah, Brian, good to be with you. I didn't either, but typically we don't see this sort of slew of evidence come out before a filing decision has been made on in terms of charges. Of course, there's the lawsuit pending, so I'm not sure what the strategy was by law enforcement to release all this, especially because the investigation is not completely done, almost done, but not completely done. But you know, Brian, this was to me just a proof of just how much experience exposure, not only the armor Gutierrez has, but also Alec Baldwin. Remember that Alec Baldwin gave that exclusive interview on ABC where he said that the set was completely safe, there were no safety issues. Well, now we know that there were several crew members who were complaining about the safety issues specifically related to guns and the fact that they were completely ignored and unaddressed. And then we had one person who quit her job because of the safety issues. And then you have Gutierrez, who apparently really was just so grossly negligent. You know, she's the one who says she never knew that live ammunition was on the set. And yet she didn't really properly do a rattle test. You know, there was evidence apparently that she was rattling some of these dummy rounds, but somebody was in her ear on the radio speaking to her. I mean, just a chaotic mess that is now evident was on the set.
And look, I know the armorer was probably in shock, but in a lot of that video, it certainly seemed like she was very concerned about herself and what was going to come of her career. And the sheriff was on Good Morning America this morning and talked about some of this and talked about who might be responsible. I want you to listen to this, Sarah, and I want to get your reaction on the other side. Have a listen.
I think there was complacency, disorganization. They were not adhering to proper safety protocols and industry standards, to be honest. And so there's a degree of neglect.
Okay, so he says complacency and they were not adhering to industry standards. But Sarah, do you think that's going to be enough for there to actually be criminal charges?
Well, you know, when you have negligence and recklessness, they could be civil. There could be civil liability and or criminal liability. For there to be criminal liability, it has to rise to such a grossly negligent level, far more than any kind of civil liability. And I think you're getting closer to that here, Brian, because, you know, you have an armorer. This is her second time as an armorer on set. She's been working for about a year. And there's evidence now in text messages where she had a burning desire to bring fire live ammunition on a previous set just months prior. She was admonished and said, you know, that's dangerous, ends in tragedies. And she said, well, I'm going to fire mine anyway, you know. And you have all of these people, these crew members complaining about safety issues. None of them are being addressed. And, you know, and you still have this $1 million question pending, which is, how did this live ammunition end up on set? You've got Kenny, the gun shop owner, who's very confident he checked the 50 rounds and there were dummies. Then you have apparently another, the prop master said there was another source for some of the ammunition, and that Gutierrez herself brought ammunition from a prior set. All of these are big no-nos, and that is why that the production company is being fined to the tune of approximately $136,000. So clearly there were scathing violations of protocol and industry standards. And I believe now with this evidence, we're seeing that it's getting closer to criminal liability, not just civil.
And I've only got 10 seconds left, but real quick, Sarah, if you're Alec Baldwin's attorney, how worried are you tonight?
I would be worried from the get-go, and I would have never let him speak. He gave that interview. It was a huge mistake, and we're already seeing that the grave inconsistencies between what we're discovering in evidence and what he denied on tape. So, you know, I would be very concerned, and I would be concerned to the point where I would admonish him not to speak again. He should have never spoken in the first place.
Yeah, so interesting to see all this new video. Sarah Azari, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks, Brian.
Okay, still to come tonight, you spend a lifetime working and saving so one day you can enjoy your golden years in retirement. That's the American dream, right? Well, not so fast. Inflation is skyrocketing and banks are warning of an impending recession. And more Americans are suddenly finding out that they don't have enough money to walk away from their job. You could even be one of them. After the break, we'll tell you how much money you should have saved right now if you even plan on retiring. And we'll meet one woman who at the age of 71 had to re-enter the workforce. Welcome back to Banfield. I'm Brian Enten in for Ashley tonight. Unretirement. A few decades ago, that word didn't even exist. And the concept of retirees forced to return to the workforce should have seemed like almost like a nightmare scenario. But with inflation through the roof, gas prices soaring, and the R word, hate to even say it, recession on the horizon, unretirement is now very, very real for many people collecting Social Security. In March, 3.1% of workers who were retired a year earlier were back on the job. There are several reasons it's happening, but one of the biggest reasons is retired workers suddenly discovering they just didn't save enough to live without a steady paycheck coming in. Inflation is at a 40-year high right now. Prices for everything are skyrocketing. And what seemed like a solid nest egg 10 years ago does not always fly today. So what are you supposed to do? If you're already retired and feeling that inflation pinch, should you dust off the resume and actually start looking for a job? If you're close to retirement and don't think you'll be able to afford it, should you keep working for maybe just a few more years? After the break, I'll be joined by a retiree who recently returned to the workforce to make some extra money to keep up with higher prices, and then a financial expert, a good one, who has all of the tips and tricks you'll need to enjoy your best retirement ever. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Banfield. I'm Brian Enten in for Ashley tonight. Working, retiring, and then working again. It is called unretirement, and it's a growing trend in this country. There are several reasons for it, some good and some not so good, pretty bad. A hot job market with a worker shortage is a real positive. Recent retirees can potentially come out of retirement. They can even ask for a higher salary than they earned before and maybe even work from home this time around. But on the negative side of things, some retirees have no choice but to go back to work. Inflation and gas prices are way up, and maybe their savings just can't keep up with everything going on right now. I'm joined by Cindy Adesi. She was retired but recently returned to working 2 days per week because of everything going on. Cindy, tell me, what kind of work were you doing, and what made you decide that you wanted to go back 2 days a week?
Well, I was involved in all kinds of administration positions over my lifetime, even going back to what originally brought me to Florida, and that was running a small business. And things were going well for me, and I felt comfortable enough because as the pandemic moved in, I felt comfortable enough just retiring. I was having trouble finding work, and I thought, you know what? It's time to take a break. I've worked since I was 14, and so I thought I'd try retiring. But financially, it wasn't working out, and I was getting a little scared with the way the economy is going. And the fact that everything was inflating except my Social Security. And so consequently, right. I went back to work part-time.
And so now that you're, was it hard finding a job? Because it seems like there's so many job openings. I would imagine when you decided to go back, was it relatively easy to find something?
No, it was not. Most of the folks that started hiring on again were looking for full-time. They didn't want part-time. I do not like driving at night. I could have found a lot of opportunities if I was willing to commute in the dark. I wasn't comfortable with that. But I did manage to find a really, really nice part-time job, 2 days a week, 8 hours a day, working for a nonprofit agency that actually makes me feel good about working because I'm out there helping other folks. And so it's worthwhile. I come home, I'm tired, but I know I've done some good.
Yeah, I'm so glad to hear that. You kind of remind me of my mom, honestly, because she's been thinking about retiring. And I've been wondering with her, you know, like, is she just going to sort of go crazy with nothing to do? It must be kind of nice having something 2 days a week, especially if you feel like you're giving back.
It is. I mean, I have my hobbies. I have my gardening and my photography. And that does keep me busy. But it doesn't help pay expenses. So I've kind of had to go look for something that did bring in some income again.
Do you think you'll stick with the job for a while, or is it just temporary to sort of see what happens with the economy, see if inflation goes down, or do you think this will be a long-term thing?
I'm not thinking this is going to be going away with what's going on with our economy. I mean, everything has inflated except my Social Security. And I'm quite concerned about that. And I know there are others that are in the same position that I am. And I think as long as I am able to, I will probably stay employed at some level just to make sure I have a little bit of a cushion.
Well, I hate, Cindy, that you weren't able to retire the way that you intended to after working since you were 14. That makes me feel bad, but I'm glad you have such a good attitude about it, and thank you for coming on with us tonight.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Okay, now I want to focus on what you can do right now to make sure you are prepared to retire whenever you decide to. I'm joined by Catherine Tuggle. She is the chief content officer of HerMoney.com and the author of the book How to Money. There are good and bad reasons for unretirement, Catherine. And you just heard Cindy's story there. I mean, it really sort of broke my heart to hear her say that she worked since she was 14 years old, was looking forward to retirement. Is this a common thread that you're hearing about?
You know, I think a lot of retirees are worried about having to draw down their accounts when we are in a down market. Nobody wants to have to draw down on their accounts when they're going to be losing money. The other thing that Cindy said that was interesting is that she's working a couple of days a week, and it's work that can be done remotely. And I think that is one important bright spot to highlight here, is that in a post-COVID world, there are more remote jobs than ever. And for seniors, they might not be that tech savvy, so I understand that might be a concern. But so many large Fortune 500 companies are offering returnships right now, which sounds like internship because it's a lot like an internship. Only it's for people who might have been out of the workforce for a while. So yes, people are returning to work, but I think that there are more options for them than ever before.
Yeah, and who wouldn't want to hire someone like Cindy with all of that life experience? She's such a pleasant woman. You think she could probably find a stay-at-home job, something over the phone if she needed to. I want to share some stats with you, Catherine. I know you're well aware of these, but they sort of came as a surprise to me. 33% of Americans are saving less than 5% of their income, and 25% of Americans have no retirement savings at all. At what age do you think people should really start getting serious about saving for retirement?
I mean, ideally, you'll start in your 20s as soon as you are able to do so, because we all know the benefits of compound interest over time. People who start in their 20s, even if you start in your 40s and you save just as much, you will never make up the ground that you lost by not starting early. And so many of us, I think, when we're first in our careers, we don't take advantage of our 401ks like we should and get those matching dollars, which is just free money that we leave on the table. But, you know, when we do get older, there are catch-up contributions that you can make to an IRA and to a 401k when you're over 50 years old. And it's important that we don't lose sight of being able to make those as well.
And Cindy mentioned how it was so interesting. Her Social Security isn't going up, but the price of everything else is going up. And I can imagine how frustrating that is. You worked your whole life anxious to finally collect Social Security, something you've paid into for so long, and you realize that it doesn't cover nearly as much as it needs to because of inflation. That combined with the fact that people are also living longer, that must be an issue for retirement too. I mean, if you still retire at 65, but you're going to live much longer, you won't have as much money as you might need, right, Catherine?
It doesn't seem fair. You know, it's the classic conundrum of having to do more with less, which is a position that none of us want to be in, particularly if we've worked since we were 14 to provide a happy life for ourselves. And many of us don't realize this. Many of us who have annuities and pensions that we're counting on, they're not all adjusted for inflation. And we saw that Social Security did get an inflation bump just this year, but it's just not enough. It's just not enough. We're hearing that some food prices are up by 15-20% right now. That's that 8% bump that we saw in Social Security is not going to get us where we need to be.
And you mentioned 401ks. This is another sort of very interesting stat that surprised me about the average 401k balances of Americans. Look at this. Average 401k balances, people 45 to 54, 161,000, 55 to 64, 232,000 about, and then people over 65, 255,000. If someone has less than that average that they're seeing on their screen, is that something they should be really worried about, do you think, Catherine?
You know, I think that looking at a 401k doesn't always tell the whole story, because for so many of us, we do have those pensions. Particularly if we started in the workforce, you know, several decades ago, we do have IRAs, we do have cash accounts, we might have brokerage accounts, and we might be able to delay our Social Security. If you delay taking your Social Security from age 62 to age 70, you will get an average of 8% return on your money, which is really hard to beat anywhere else. So I think it's more about looking at your total retirement picture, and also where you want to live. Are you going to downsize? Are you going to sell a home that's quite valuable and downsize to something smaller? Are you going to move to a state with a lower cost of living? I think, you know, meeting with a financial planner who can help you map out all of these things is really so important, because you might be having stress that you just don't need to.
Makes perfect sense to think about the big picture and also think about exactly what kind of lifestyle you want to have in retirement. Catherine Tuggle, thank you so much. You are always so good at breaking all of this down and making it understandable. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Okay, after the break, one Massachusetts family has turned hundreds of golf balls into millions of dollars. Find out how they did it and why they describe their Massachusetts home as a prison. That's coming up. Welcome back to Banfield. Golf is a game of patience, precision, and a little bit of luck, and a whole lot of lost golf balls. But for one Massachusetts family, their patience, it has finally run out. In 2017, Eric and Athena Tenskar bought their dream home near Indian Pond Country Club. And since moving in, they have collected nearly 700 golf balls, which equates to millions of dollars, but not from actually reselling the golf balls. Golf balls have literally rained down on their home, breaking windows, causing shards of glass to fly across rooms, denting siding, and placing their three young daughters in the crosshairs. Look at all those broken windows. They've described their once dream home as a prison and said, when it hits, it sounds like a gunshot. After constant inaction from the country club, the Tenskars were left with one option, they say, filing a lawsuit against the country club. In December of 2021, they were actually awarded $4.9 million. A jury came up with that number for damages and emotional suffering for everything they have been through there in the house. Wow, this is wild. The hail of golf balls and constant fear has finally now subsided as the country club reconfigured the 15th hole to face away from the home. However, they say they will not be selling the home for fear of putting another family through the ordeal. It's a pretty nice house. I can see why they wouldn't want to sell it. Okay, now we turn things over to Marnie Hughes and Leland Vittert. They will be taking it from here. I don't work in Chicago, Leland, but the word on the street is that you have a putting green in your office. I know you like golf, but I'm hoping you've got better precision, that you're not like constantly taking out people's windows.
I have several broken windows because poor course design or Leland's needs more practice.